Good morning. Would you please state your full name and spell just your last name?
Todd Cameron Gray, G-R-E-Y.
What's your profession?
I'm the chief medical examiner for the state of Utah.
How long have you been the chief medical examiner?
Since 1988.
Explain what that position involves.
In addition to being the head administrative officer for the death investigation system here in Utah, I also work as a forensic pathologist, doing examinations and certifying deaths that come under the jurisdiction of my office.
Explain to us what the field of forensic pathology involves.
Forensic pathology is a subspecialty of medicine that essentially is involved in the investigation of sudden and unexpected death.
And are you board certified in that specialty?
Yes, I am.
What other areas are you board certified?
I'm also board certified in anatomic pathology.
And explain what that is.
That is, a branch of medicine involved in the investigation and diagnosis of tissue abnormalities and disease.
Are you board certified in any other areas?
No.
Tell us about your educational background, if you will.
I received my undergraduate degree from Yale University, my medical degree from Dartmouth Medical School, my training in anatomic pathology at the University of California in San Diego, and my training in forensic pathology at the Dade County Medical Examiner's Office in Miami, Florida.
And tell us about your employment history.
Prior to coming to Utah, I was in Miami, Florida, receiving training in forensic pathology. Prior to that, I worked as a staff pathologist in Gallup, New Mexico. Prior to that, I was in training.
Would you tell us in general about the process of performing an autopsy?
Mm-hmm. An autopsy examination commences with a careful external examination of the body, noting any signs of abnormality, disease, or injury. That is followed by a complete internal examination of the various organs of the body, including the brain, with the same purpose in mind.
Do you supervise other physicians who also work for the medical examiner's office?
Yes.
Do you consult with them as to cases where they perform autopsies?
Yes.
And do you also have investigators that work with the medical examiner's office?
Yes, we do.
Tell us about their function.
The investigator is a person that essentially helps put a death in context for us. They will be the ones that gather information about who the person is, the circumstances surrounding their death, and other demographic and investigative information.
What questions are you attempting to answer during the entire autopsy process?
How did this person come to their death?
Tell us what, in your field, the phrase cause of death means.
Cause of death is that disease, injury, or other pathologic abnormality that led to death. And you can have immediate causes, intervening causes, and underlying causes.
What does the phrase manner of death mean?
Manner of death is a classification of the circumstances surrounding the death. There are essentially five manners of death possible. Natural, meaning death is due to some natural disease process. Accident, meaning it was an untoward or unexpected event. Suicide, meaning it was self-inflicted. Homicide, meaning it was the result of actions by another, intentional actions by another person, or undetermined, meaning we can't tell.
As you reach conclusions as to each of those categories, what information do you rely on? Is it limited to medical findings, or do you also consider other information?
The determination of both cause and manner of death is based on the totality of information available that provides us with an indication of what happened to this person.
Can you offer an estimate of the number of death investigations you've been personally involved with, autopsy processes, over your whole career?
If you limit it to solely autopsy cases, I'm about 7,800 to 7,900. If it includes non-autopsy investigations as well, I'm a bit over 11,000 personally.
Roughly, how many of those have involved children under the age of 10?
Probably on the order of about 750 to 1,000.
Have you received specialized training in identification of the cause and timing of injuries to young children?
Well, to the cause and timing of all injuries, and with understanding of any differences that might be there for juveniles, yes.
Has your training also focused on differentiating between inflicted injuries and those caused by accident?
Yes.
Have you received specialized training in recognition of child abuse-related injuries?
Yes.
Give us some examples.
I'm not really sure that's such a broad topic. Child abuse injuries are essentially any type of injury that has been inflicted on a child. The types of injuries that you see are not different from injuries that may happen in accidental events. The differences come more in both the extent and pattern of injury as well as the circumstances surrounding how that child came to be injured.
How many cases have you been involved with in death investigations where child abuse was at least among the differential diagnoses that you were considering?
Probably several hundred.
Have you also consulted with others on cases where you were not directly involved?
Yes.
Have you testified as an expert witness on the cause and manner of death in children in courts in Utah and elsewhere?
Yes, I have.
Any estimate of the number of times?
Any testimony or just in child abuse cases?
Just in child abuse related cases.
At least 50 to 100.
Let me show you now what's been marked as State's Exhibit number 19. Okay. perhaps ask if that's an accurate and current copy of your curriculum vitae.
Yes.
I'd offer State's Exhibit Number 19. Right?
No, Judge.
State's Exhibit 19 is received.
I'd like to ask you some general questions about anatomy and basic functions of various parts of the body. And I'd like to begin with what's marked as State's Exhibit 45. Just illustrate for us the basic anatomy of the human heart,
okay,
and just basically how it functions.
Okay. The heart is an organ for the pumping of blood through the body. Blood first returns to the heart through the vena cava, either the superior or upper one, or the inferior lower one. These major veins drain into the first pumping chamber of the heart called the right atrium. That pumps blood into the right ventricle, which is a larger and more muscular chamber that will then pump blood out the pulmonary artery so that it flows through the lungs and becomes oxygenated. The oxygenated blood returns from the lungs into the left atrium, which subsequently pushes the blood into the left ventricle, which is the strongest and most muscular of the pumping chambers of the heart, that then pushes it out through the aorta to be distributed throughout the body and eventually then return through the veins back to the heart.
Show you now what's been marked as State's Exhibit 46 for illustrative purposes. And tell us in this diagram what the pericardium is and its function.
The pericardium is essentially a membranous sac that encases the heart and separates it from the other structures and organs of the upper of the chest.
What's the significance of the pericardium in terms of injuries to the heart?
The pericardium itself can be injured or torn if it is not disrupted, and there is an injury of the heart. It can essentially act as a constraint for blood loss, and if blood fills the pericardial sac, it may actually cause restriction of the ability of the heart to pump.
So if the heart is injured in a way that causes blood loss within the structures of the heart, but the pericardium is not torn in some way, what is the effect of that?
That would lead to what's called pericardial tamponade, or filling of the heart sac with blood, and then a compromise of the ability of the heart to pump.
If a person has that type of injury, in general, how long would that person have to survive?
Depending on how fast the blood is accumulating within the pericardium, death could result in a matter of minutes.
And if you would just point on the diagram to the pericardium.
The pericardium is this outer sac, and it's shown as the outer wall here. The pericardial space, essentially the space between the outer surface of the heart and the pericardium, is in blue here.
And, Your Honor, for the purpose of this hearing, I would offer exhibits 45 and 46 for illustrative purposes.
No objection. 45 and 46 are received.
Dr. Gray, did you conduct an autopsy on a 7-year-old girl named Sunamu on April 2nd of 2008?
Yes.
What time did the autopsy begin that day?
That started at approximately 8:10 a.m.
Who was present during the autopsy?
In addition to myself and assistance from my office, the procedure was observed by Chris Francis and Damon Byington of South Salt Lake Police Department and Agent Stephen Pickens of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Your Honor, for the record, it appears Dr. Gray is reading directly from his report. I just wanted to note that. I'm not objecting to that.
Okay, go ahead.
Were photographs taken during the autopsy?
Yes.
Who took the photographs?
The majority of them would have been taken by one of my assistants. I may have also participated.
Have you reviewed many of those photographs prior to testifying today?
Yes.
Let me just ask if you prepared a report.
Yes, I did.
And let me show you State's Exhibit 20. Okay. Just ask if that's a full copy of your complete autopsy report.
The first 10 pages are a copy of my report and the toxicology report. That is followed by 4 pages of an investigative report produced by my investigator, Brent Marchant. The next page is a copy of the partially completed death certificate that I produced. The second page is another copy of the death certificate. The 16th page is a copy of what appears to be a handout indicating a lost child. The next page, 17, is a copy of the request form submitted indicating what samples were provided for toxicologic analysis. The 18th page is a copy of a report from Dr. Lori Fraser concerning her findings on colposcopic examination. And the next page is a copy of what appears to be an obituary from the Salt Lake Tribune. The next page, 20th, is a copy of a diagram from the examination of the fixed brain in this case. Page 21 is a copy of my diagram that I completed during the process of examination. 22 is a copy of a autopsy worksheet completed during the process of examination. 23 is a copy of a face sheet of the first of the dictation done in this case with various handwritten notations concerning the progress of work done on the case until finalized. 24 is the second page of that initial transcription. 25 is a copy of a photograph log saying what photographs were taken and where they were stored. 26 is a copy of the body receiving and release form indicating the condition and clothing on the body when first received, and then what happened to the body after we were finished. 27 is a copy of a request for copies of the report from both Detective Byington and Special Agent Pickens. 28 is a copy of an evidence release sheet indicating what pieces of evidence were turned over to Detective Byington by my office. And page 29 is a copy of footprints taken at the time of examination.
And is this an accurate copy of all the documents that were related to your process?
Yes.
I would offer Exhibit 29.
Before you receive it, may I see that for me?
You may. State's Exhibit 20 is received.
Dr. Gray, what information did you have concerning the circumstances of the search for and the discovery of this little girl's body?
Essentially, the information I was given is that she was reported missing on the 31st of March, that a search ensued, and eventually her body was discovered in a shower stall in a apartment in the same complex where she lived.
Were you informed as to what time of day and what day her body was discovered?
Yes. She was found on the 1st of April, approximately 7:30.
Were you provided photographs of the crime scene to show the location of her body?
Yes.
What was Sunamu's age at the time of her death?
7.
Was that stated age consistent with what you found during your process of evaluation?
Yes, her body appeared consistent with that age.
What was her weight at the time of the autopsy?
It was recorded as 23 kilograms, so just over 50 pounds. Her height was 118 centimeters, so 46 and a half inches.
Given the information you were provided, including all the investigative information and what you found during the autopsy, were you able to form an opinion as to the likely time of the death of Sunamu?
No. I would not offer an opinion, being able to say with any certainty when that happened.
Were you able to form an opinion as to the cause of her death?
Yes.
What was your opinion as to what caused Sunamu to die?
I certified her death as resulting from blunt force injuries of her head, neck, torso, and left wrist.
And were you able to reach an opinion as to the manner of her death?
Yes.
What was your opinion?
I certified this as a homicide.
And just for the record again, a homicide is?
A death resulting from the intentional actions of another person.
Would you tell us about the injuries that you documented with Sunamu, and then we'll go through some photographs and have you illustrate those in more detail.
Okay. The injuries I found in this case were extensive. Starting with the head, I found bruising of her forehead, both externally and internally. There was a laceration or tear of the skin with surrounding scraping and bruising in the left temporal region. There was extensive bruising and swelling of her left cheek and jaw, with the jaw joint being somewhat disrupted but not actually broken or disarticulated. There was bruising of the inner aspect of her left lower lip. There was bruising of the muscle of the tip of her tongue. Internally, I found bruising on the inner surface of her scalp, predominantly over the right frontal region, but also in the left frontal region. She did not have any evidence of fracturing of her skull. She did have a thin coating of blood between the inner surface of the skull and the surface of her brain. Her brain also had evidence of swelling or cerebral edema. The next area of injury was her neck. Externally, I found bruising on the front of her neck. Internally, I found bruising of the soft tissues just beneath the skin, as well as bruising of one of the muscles of the neck, specifically the left sternothyroid, a muscle that goes from the top of the breastplate to the Adam's apple area. There was also blood dissecting along the cervical spine. In my opinion, associated with that damage to the neck was the finding of petechiae, pinpoint hemorrhages, involving the whites of the eyes and the inner surfaces of the lower eyelids. Her torso was remarkable for external injury over the central sternal region, specifically bruising. I found deeper hemorrhage in the musculature of the front of the chest. She did not have any rib fractures. But she did have extensive blood dissecting through the central structures of the chest called the mediastinum. Her tissues were actually pulled away from her upper spine in the upper chest region. She had bruising of both lungs on their back surfaces. She had a tear of her heart involving the right atrium with the accumulation of approximately 80 cc's of blood within her intact pericardium. She had bruising of the mesentery, which is the fan of fat and tissue that supports the intestines. She had bruising of the tissues behind the back of the abdominal cavity with bruising around the head of the pancreas and surrounding the right kidney. She also had a fracture of the left wrist area, specifically the radius and ulna, which are the two bones of the forearm, that were broken just before the wrist joint. There was bruising of her back, seen both on the skin as well as the deeper muscular tissues. And finally, she had petechial contusions of the periurethral and hymenal tissues, so essentially in the vaginal region.
Was there any natural disease or other metabolic process that related at all to the cause of her death?
No, I found no other pathologic abnormalities that I felt would either cause or significantly contribute to death.
Any toxic substances found that might have had anything to do with her death?
No.
I'd like to show you now what have been marked as State's Exhibits 21 through 44. This may take a moment because I need to show them to the defense. Showing you now exhibits 21 through 44. Would you briefly just review these and verify that they are photographs that accurately depict what was found and seen at the time that you were doing the autopsy?
At the scene or at the autopsy?
No, what was found and observed, I should say, at the time of autopsy.
Okay.
And your answer to that question?
The answer is these are all appear to be photographs taken at the time of examination and document relevant findings that we've already previously discussed.
I would offer exhibits 21 through 44.
Exhibits 21 through 44 are received.
So I'd like now to go through using the projector, and we'll look at various combinations of these photographs. Beginning with exhibit number 21, what is depicted here?
This is a photograph of articles of clothing that were on the body that were taken after they were removed at my office. This is a pair of shorts taken from the body and photographed at my office.
Did the items of clothing have significance in terms of some of the findings that you made?
The findings that I noted were that the clothing was wet or moist, and that there appeared to be blood staining of the jacket.
Moving on then, exhibit number 23. Tell us what we're observing here.
This is a photograph taken at the time of examination prior to cleaning that shows the laceration in the left temporal region and a fairly extensive dried blood on the face.
Other than this laceration, was there any other obvious tear of her skin?
No.
And just for the record, the laceration is just above the ruler that's being held?
Right there.
Exhibit 24.
This is the same injury photographed more closely and after cleaning.
Do you have an opinion as to what likely caused this injury?
This is a laceration, meaning a blunt force injury where this tensile strength of the skin has been exceeded so that the tissue is actually rip and tear. This could be from a blow, it could be from an impact striking a fixed object. In and of itself, I cannot differentiate between those mechanisms.
What degree of force does it take to cause the blunt force laceration of the skin?
Really does depend on how blunt that force is. If it's the head is struck with something with a fairly sharp and distinct edge, it wouldn't take as much as if it was hit with something smoother, rounder, without irregularity or sharpness.
What would she have felt after experiencing this injury?
That would hurt. That would be a painful injury.
And I think you indicated there was a substantial amount of blood on her face. Was there other blood that was clearly from this injury that you could identify?
Well, there was blood on her jacket, and I would it would be reasonable to suspect that that blood came from this injury because, as you noted, I saw no other external injuries that would bleed.
Did you find any evidence of lacerations or things that would bleed inside of her mouth?
Inside of her mouth, no.
Moving on to exhibit number 25, what's depicted here?
This is a photograph taken at the time of examination, and this shows the skull and the scalp, which has been reflected or turned down over the face, so that you're seeing the inner surface of the scalp.
And what is significant in terms of the injuries?
There are areas of hemorrhage, as you said, mostly over the right frontal portion of the skull and on the scalp, as well as bruising of the left scalp and soft tissues in the temporal region.
Would you use the laser pointer and just show us what you mean?
So this is bruising on the outer surface of the skull, which is corresponds to the bruising that we see on the inner surface of the scalp. This is the bruising in the left temporal region, and there is slight bruising here in the left frontal scalp.
In your opinion, what would cause these kinds of findings?
These are, again, blunt force injuries, the application of force to the tissues, whether through a blow or an impact. I cannot tell the difference.
Are you able... Are you able to differentiate the number of blows that are evidenced?
Not with any certainty. I mean, I certainly can say that we have at least three impacts or blows, but there certainly could be more. And when I say three, I mean right, left, and left temporal.
And the bruising and the blood that you've indicated under the scalp on the left temple, is that associated with that blunt force tear that you've talked about?
Yes.
Is it directly underneath it?
Not directly, but it is in the area, so it's probably tissue that was damaged in that same process that caused the laceration.
Moving on to exhibit number 26. Tell us what we're seeing here.
This is a photograph taken at examination showing the findings after the top of the skull has been removed and the brain exposed. What we're seeing here is the thin coating of blood called subdural blood over the right side of the brain.
What's your opinion as to the likely cause of that?
Again, this would be consistent with the application of force to the head, either through blows or impact.
Was there evidence of damage to the brain itself?
Not in the sense of blunt force injury that I could say here's a bruise or here's an area where the brain was bleeding. The brain did have swelling or edema, and that is a common finding when the brain has been, suffered any kind of an insult. That insult could be a blow or impact. It could also be a lack of oxygen.
I'm sorry, a lack of what?
Lack of oxygen.
Moving on to exhibit 27, explain what this is.
This is a photograph taken of the brain after removal and fixation in formaldehyde for a number of days. What this is showing is that there is a slightly smoother and flatter appearance to the surface of the brain, which goes along with edema.
Did you form an opinion as to whether trauma to the brain had anything to do with the cause of her death?
Yes.
And what was your opinion about that?
Yes, I included blunt force injuries of the head as part of the determination of cause of death.
Given the entire collection of head injuries that you've talked about with Sunamu, what is the overall significance of that collection of injuries in terms of what likely happened to cause them?
The majority of findings on the head are indicative of blunt force trauma, meaning blows or impacts to the head. There is the potential for a separate mechanism of injury, specifically restriction of oxygen or blood flow to the brain as potentially contributing to her head injury.
As you consider the entire collection of these injuries, are they consistent with having been caused sometime during the afternoon of March 31st of 2008?
Yes.
Well, I'd object, Judge. He indicated he wasn't able to specify a date of death or time of death in his previous examination.
It's a different question, Your Honor. When I ask if they're consistent with having been caused at that
time. I got it.
Explain that answer, if you will.
Okay. These are all acute injuries. I saw no evidence that would indicate that these were injuries that were older and had had some period of time for the body to try to heal. Can I tell you that they happened when they happened specifically? No, but they are distinctly perimortem or immediately premortem injury.
Moving on then to external injuries. Exhibit 28, tell us what we're seeing here.
This is a photograph taken at the time of the examination documenting the bruising that was seen over the central chest.
If you would illustrate, what is bruising here that we're seeing?
So this diffuse sort of red-purple color is not bruising. That's the settling of blood after death called lividity. What we are talking about are these much more distinct, darker, patterned red-purple discolorations over the central chest.
And while we're talking about lividity, explain that process a little bit and what that pattern tells you in terms of the position she was in when she passed away.
Lividity, as I said, is the settling of blood with gravity after death, so that the areas of the body that are dependent or downwards will develop a somewhat diffuse red-purple hue. You may see areas where that does not form, where the body is actually resting against something, so areas of pressure may have clearing. In this case, the anterior pattern of lividity indicates that the body was face down or in a position with the torso dependent for some period of time after death and before being placed on its back for our examination.
And based on the photographs that you were able to review of the position of the body at the time of discovery, is that consistent with this pattern of lividity?
Yes.
Moving on then to Exhibit 29. Tell us what is shown here.
This is another photograph taken at the time of examination, and in this case we are showing that the straps from the top seem to have a pattern that matches what we're seeing in terms of the bruises on the front of the torso, which would indicate that they were present when force was applied.
And when you say it's from the top, what did you mean by that?
The shirt that the child was wearing.
That was shown in the first exhibit that was shown.
Yes, in exhibit 21.
What type of trauma do you believe was applied to cause this bruising?
Again, this is blunt force injury. Either a blow or an impact could lead to that pattern of injury.
Was this clearly a premortem injury?
Yes.
Explain, please.
The reason I say premortem is I found evidence of hemorrhage in the underlying subcutaneous tissues, which means this person had to have some degree of blood pressure so that blood would be pushed out into the damaged tissues.
Moving on then to Exhibit 30, what's shown here?
This is a photograph depicting the back of the body after undressing and I believe prior to complete washing.
Exhibit 31.
This is a close-up or a closer shot of the back taken at the time of examination, and it is depicting an area of bruising in the right central back region.
What's your opinion as to the likely cause of that?
Again, this is blunt force trauma, a blow or an impact.
Could it be consistent with blows with a fist, for instance?
It certainly could be caused by that, yes.
Okay. Or an object.
Or an object.
What else do we see in this?
There is a little another area of petechial or pinpoint contusion above this, and I can't see, it's very faint here, but there are more distinct oval bruises in the upper back.
Moving on then to exhibit 32 and 33, is that what you just referred to?
32 is a better depiction of the area of injury in the upper central back, which has a series of somewhat oval bruises lined up vertically. 33 is shows that we have made incisions or cuts in the skin and show the underlying hemorrhage in the subcutaneous tissues associated with what we're seeing externally.
And what's your opinion of the likely cause of this injury or set?
Again, blunt force injuries, blows or impact, and specifically something with fairly distinct ridging or knobbiness to it so that you have distinct impact points separated by clear skin.
Possibly knuckles?
Knuckles could certainly do that.
Who was it that made the incisions on Exhibit 33?
Me.
And what was the purpose again?
To document the underlying subcutaneous hemorrhage.
And what was the significance of finding that underlying subcutaneous hemorrhage?
This would indicate that, number one, these are truly bruises, and that the person had blood pressure at the time they were the bruises were caused.
So confirming premortem.
Yes. Pre-mortem.
Moving you want on. To hold up for just a second?
Sure.
Okay. Good? All right, go ahead.
Moving on then to internal injuries of her chest and back, if we could. Starting with Exhibit 34, what are we seeing here?
This is a photograph taken at the time of examination that is depicting the musculature and soft tissues of the front of the chest.
And what is significant in terms of injury?
What we're seeing is that there are areas of bleeding or hemorrhage in the muscles of the central chest, where I'm indicating the pointer sort of towards the left and superiorly or upwards, as well as here more on the right side.
So what is your opinion as to the likely cause of the bleeding here?
This would be, again, blunt force trauma, and this is in association with what we saw externally over the center of the chest, indicating that the force was applied to cause damage to the underlying muscle.
Does the fact that there's damage to the muscles and hemorrhage into the muscles give you some idea of the nature of the blunt force trauma?
Nature, no. Intensity, yes.
And that was the question I meant to ask. So if you wouldn't mind answering the
better
question.
Essentially, it means that the deeper the damage goes, the more force is required to cause the injury.
Moving on then to Exhibit 35. What's shown here?
This is a photograph taken at the time of examination, depicting the musculature of the back after the skin has been reflected back, and we have made incisions to show the deeper musculature of the upper back. And in this case, there are areas of hemorrhage in the deeper musculature of the upper back. The head is up here, the feet are over towards me. And so this would, again, correlate with what we saw externally in terms of the distinct oval bruising and indicate that a fairly significant force was associated with those external bruises.
So, just to make the record clear, the bleeding that we're seeing here is roughly underneath where those oval bruises were.
Yes.
On exhibits 31 and 32.
That's correct.
And finally, exhibit 36.
This is a photograph taken at the time of examination, showing the chest and abdominal cavities after the removal of all organs. And it shows the hemorrhage that is in the deep tissues behind the back wall of the abdominal cavity, or what's called retroperitoneal hemorrhage.
And what is your opinion as to the likely cause of that?
This is, again, consistent with blunt force trauma, the delivery of force to the body. I cannot say if it is from a blow necessarily to the back, though we do have some bruising in the lower right back, or it could actually be from a blow to the abdomen on the front. I can't exclude that as a possibility.
With either of those possibilities, what type of force would have been involved with that kind of blow?
This is a deep injury and would require significant force to be able to result.
You talked earlier about the fracture of the left arm.
Forearm.
Tell us what is shown then in exhibits 37 and 38.
37 is a photograph taken at the time of examination, and it shows the marked deformity of the distal left forearm. Essentially, you have almost a second joint here. And this exhibit 38 is an x-ray taken at my office, showing the complete fractures of the radius and ulna.
What type of force would be necessary to result in this finding?
Again, this is significant force to break those bones.
What type of cause might result in this?
This is something where the bones have essentially been snapped. So there is a sharp bending of the bone that exceeds its tensile strength, and the bone breaks.
So what you're demonstrating, just for the record, is something bending the bone from both sides.
Well, something so that you can't just move the arm. You have to immobilize that point, either point, and then apply force across where the break occurs.
After this was experienced by the child, what would she have felt?
And again, this would be a very painful injury.
And is this clearly a premortem injury?
Yes.
What's the basis of your opinion about that?
The hemorrhage that was associated with it.
Moving on then. What is shown in exhibits 39 and 40?
39 is a photograph taken at the time of examination, showing the chin, left cheek, neck and upper chest, and specifically it's showing, again, irregular petechial and patterned contusion of the skin over the front of the neck. And Exhibit 40 is a close-up of that, showing the distinct patterned bruising.
While we're on Exhibit 39, you testified earlier about the extensive bruising of the left cheek and the injury to the jaw. Tell us, while we're here looking at it, what you think is the likely cause of that.
So what we're talking about is this diffuse red-purple color involving the cheek and the chin, as well as the angle of the jaw. This is consistent with, again, blunt force. Whether it's a blow or an impact, I cannot say. It's also associated with that hypermobility or ease of movement in the left jaw joint that I described previously.
What type of cause would potentially result in this?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Would it require an object? Could it be fists?
Could be a fist, could be a foot, could be an object, as long as it is relatively smooth or soft so that I don't see variegation in the pattern.
Would this be consistent with a single blow or multiple, or can you tell?
I can't tell.
Now, moving back to the neck injuries, what was the significance of these bruises on the neck?
This means that there has been force applied to the front of the neck.
Moving on then, what's shown in Exhibit 41?
This is a photograph showing the dissection of the musculature of the neck during the process of examination. You can see that the top of the head is here, feet are down below. What we have done is I have pulled back the two largest muscles of the neck, called the sternocleidomastoids, and now you can see there is an area of hemorrhage or bruising of the left sternothyroid muscle.
And what's the significance of that?
It means that there has been force applied to the neck, which is sufficient to cause damage or to